Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. This program was recorded on Wednesday evening, November 10, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speakers will be Chuck Hagel, former two-term Republican senator from Nebraska, and John Yishui, ambassador of the People's Republic of China to the United States. The topic of their discussion will be China Rising, Good News or Bad News for United States Workers, Consumers, and Investors. This event is being co-presented as the Charles and Linda Wilson Dialogue on Domestic Issues. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Harvey Perelman, Chancellor of the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
Our speakers this evening are well prepared to comment on China's growing global presence. First to speak will be the Honorable Chuck Hagel, who represented Nebraska in the United States Senate from 1997 to 2009. During his two terms, he was a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations, Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs, and Intelligence Committees. He was chairman of the Congressional Executive Commission on China and the Senate Climate Change Observer Group. He is now a distinguished professor at Georgetown University and the University of Nebraska at Omaha, his collegiate alma mater. He is also the author of America, Our Next Chapter, an examination of the current state of the nation that provides substantial proposals for the challenges of the 21st century. After Chuck Hagel's remarks, Ambassador Zhang Yushui of the People's Republic of China to the United States will speak. He is a native of Hubei Province. Prior to serving as ambassador to the United States, he was China's permanent representative to the United Nations and vice minister of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He graduated from Beijing Foreign Studies University and studied at the London School of Economics. After both men's remarks, you will have the opportunity to ask questions by writing them on cards provided by the ushers. The discussion of ideas and questions will be moderated by Dr. Tim Borstelman, who is the Elwood N. and Catherine Thompson Professor of Modern World History. Professor Borstelman joined UNL in 2003. His areas of interest are 20th century United States history, international relations, and world history. He holds a bachelor's degree from Stanford and master's and doctoral degrees from Duke. The title of tonight's presentation is China Rising, Good News or Bad News for U.S. Workers, Consumers, and Investors. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel this evening.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. Chancellor Perelman, thank you for your introduction and also for your continued leadership of a distinguished and important institution for our country that has, in many ways, been a leader in focusing on international relations, the relevancy, the importance of those relationships as we have entered a dynamic, uncertain, dangerous, complicated new century. But a new century that offers astounding historic opportunities. Maybe more opportunities than any new century has ever offered mankind. I wish to also thank this institution, the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, certainly the E.N. Thompson Forum, to give us an opportunity to exchange some views tonight about this critically important issue. The Cooper Fund, and our friends, Dr. and Mrs. Chuck Wilson, for their continued leadership in community developments and helping make Nebraska a better state. I certainly would also begin my remarks this evening with a note of congratulation to the Cornhuskers. The ambassador, if he does well tonight, will be treated to a tour of Memorial Stadium. If he does exceptionally well, he'll get to see Martinez's locker. That was incentive enough to get the ambassador to agree to come to Nebraska. I want to thank my friend Ambassador Jiang for taking 2 days of his time to come to Nebraska, and also his wife, Madam Chen, who is in the audience. So to each of you, thank you for being with us tonight. This morning's headline in the New York Times read, China challenges role of U.S. on eve of economic meeting. The headline in the Washington Post yesterday read, disputes, disappointment strain U.S. relations with China. 2 weeks ago, The Economist magazine highlighted a cover story on China. The title of that Economist cover story was The Next Emperor, and it was about the next leader of China. And these are but two examples of the concentration of emphasis, of focus, of awareness and importance on this very, very critical, probably the most critical relationship for the 21st century, the relationship between the United States and China. This is a relationship that must be right. It must be right for not just the two countries and their people, but for the world. This weekend in South Korea, the G20 meets. Both of the presidents representing China and the United States will be there. Much of that discussion will center around the issues that are being played out daily in newspapers and magazines around the world, currency valuations, trade, and other issues, which we will examine tonight in some detail. And I think most of you know that Chinese President Hu will visit the United States in January. Tonight, the ambassador and I were asked in our remarks, and probably more importantly in the exchange with you, to focus on expectations of Nebraskans, Americans, in this relationship. Should there be expectations? If so, what kind of expectations should there be? What is possible? Has globalization really enhanced our lives, or has globalization made our lives more complicated, more dangerous? I have always believed, and I thought this in the Senate when I had many opportunities to visit China, and had my first opportunity to visit China when I was in the private sector as a businessman, arriving in China on January 1st of 1984, that as you examine this great country and the consequences of our relationship with this country, yes, expectations are important, and the realities of those expectations must anchor whatever we think through about this relationship. But to try and isolate a state, Nebraska, whatever state, on a basis of our citizens' expectations for our relationship with China, it really is incomplete. We can't isolate a state or an industry or a region because we are living now in a totally interconnected world. So it isn't just Nebraskans, but it's Americans and it's other and all citizens of the world that are and will continue to be affected by this relationship. There is something about the word China that evokes strong feelings among Americans. We respect the ancient culture and philosophy that underpins the Chinese civilization, and we respond positively to the Chinese people themselves on a personal level. Yet many Americans also instinctively fear and distrust this distant, large, different, and enormously populous nation that is once again rising to a prominent role in the world. By virtue of its size and economic strength, it will most likely be, alongside America, the major player in the world in this century. There is no strategic relationship more important to the world, or more important to the United States, than the relationship with China. At the same time, there are few more open to contention and discord, as we see both cooperation and competition in our relationship. And that cooperation and competition increases daily. Human rights, intellectual property rights, balance of trade, currency valuations, Taiwan, and other important differences are issues that divide us. But just as we have these divisive issues, we have mutual common interests issues where we are working together and will continue to work together, like the North Korean threat, Iran, terrorism, regional stability, environmental concerns, and others. However, as I noted earlier, we must be realistic and very clear-headed in our approach to these issues, and we must remain balanced and insightful. History has shown that the way to encourage more open societies, human rights, and democratic development is through engagement, trade, communication, educational exchanges, and direct contact among people. As Richard Nixon recommended over 40 years ago in a Foreign Affairs magazine article, quote, "For the long run, it means pulling China back into the world community, but as a great and progressing nation, not as the epicenter of world revolution." End of quote. This has been the policy of every American president since Nixon. A constructive bilateral relationship with China that is one of the most important steps America can take toward building a world more aligned with our own interests and our own leadership and our own prosperity. We often think of America as a nation anchored by a strong middle class, and it is. But consider this fact. China currently has a middle class larger than the entire population of the United States. Over 300 million people investing in their country and the world. We also need to recognize that there are still hundreds of millions of Chinese living in some degree of poverty. Still, China's direction is clearly toward further economic development and an ever larger middle class. China's rate of growth has few historical parallels. A film of the Shanghai skyline over the last few years would more than anything show constant change, like a time-lapse video of a plant going from seed to tree in a matter of minutes. Before the middle of this century, if it continues growing at its current rate, China's economy may be larger than America's economy. Chinese foreign policy, once driven by ideology, is now more concerned with quality of life for its people, stability, regional stability, jobs, energy resources, and development of its economy. This policy has had dramatic effects beyond commerce, both inside China and around the world. For instance, this year, China hosted the 2010 World Expo and hosted the 2008 Summer Olympics. And in 2000, China established the China-Africa Cooperation Forum to help Beijing pursue energy-related contracts, develop trade and investment agreements, expand scientific and technical cooperation, and support greater tourism between China and Africa. Much is made of the artificial exchange rate between the Chinese and American currencies. This is a legitimate issue. and it will be an issue of supreme importance and a major topic of this week's G20 meeting in South Korea. The argument goes that cheap currency in China represents a backdoor subsidy to the Chinese economy that gives it an unfair export advantage while destroying American jobs. As is often the case with simplistic economic arguments, especially those bolstered by nationalism on both sides, this does not represent the whole truth, which is far more complex and often very different from what it appears to be at first glance. This is also the argument being made by China and European nations and other nations against the recent U.S. monetary decision to infuse $600 billion of new money in the U.S. economy. Aren't we doing the same thing? People ask. Isn't it the same? If America stopped buying from China, we would still be faced with the same dynamic. A world economy driven by a world market producing cheap quality products made in not just China, but many countries. All 7 billion people in the face of the earth today live in an interconnected global community underpinned by an interconnected global economy. We are living in a world market. All citizens of the world are part of one world market. The components of many products come from many places around the world, for all products, but are assembled in one location. For example, much of the clothing that Americans buy that bears a Made in China label is made with thread from Vietnam, silk from Thailand, and cotton from India, but assembled in China. You might have as many as 6 or 7 items from 6 or 7 different countries woven into this same Chinese product. We cannot control the global marketplace. The market is more powerful than any individual, any government, any company, or any country. The answer to the challenge of Chinese-made products is for America to continue to invest in the productive technologies that advanced societies are capable of generating and financing, and that an educated, skilled, and trained labor force is capable of manning. This is called being competitive on 21st century terms. The law of comparative advantage always dominates and always wins. The China-United States economic relationship is critically important to our domestic economy. We understand that. So we examine another facet of this relationship. Today, China holds hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. Treasury securities. The Chinese have bet on the American economy and the strength of the dollar. In other words, the Chinese have been helping to finance our debt and prop up our currency. Current total U.S. debt held by the public today is over $9 trillion. Of this amount, over half is held by foreign investors. The People's Republic of China and Japan have the largest percentage of ownership of America's debt. China is a world power. It will continue to be an even greater world power. We cannot control China, nor should we try. Neither should we be shocked when the Chinese decide to spend more on defense. All great powers in history have always sought to enhance and modernize their military and strengthen their security. Do we need to be mindful of that? Of course we do. Of course we do. Do we need to think tactically and strategically about how we might respond to that military buildup, how it might affect America's position in the world, how it might affect sea lanes in the world, the independence of nations in the world? Again, of course. But we also need to be thoughtful, wise, and judicious as we analyze our security interests as well as other countries' security interests. America's commitment to its security in dollars represents a larger expenditure for defense spending than all of the nations of the world combined. Over $700 billion per year, including monies for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That represents more than half of our total federal budget discretionary spending. And that does not include security spending for the Homeland Security Department, nor our intelligence agencies. But we are far more likely to be able to live peacefully with China and influence China and affect the direction that China takes over the next few years if we are bound to China by strong economic ties and mutual geopolitical and security interests as an ally and competitor, rather than one that we face as an adversary and enemy. As we project America's interests in this new world, as we construct a new world order that will include China, must include China, as it must include India and Brazil, nations of Southeast Asia, Turkey, South Korea, we must recognize the interests of these countries and forge relationships, build the foundation of those relationships on the common interests, not the differences, but the common interests. Our sovereign interests, like all sovereign nations have sovereign interests, are not, need not be exclusive to the sovereign interests of other nations. We are seeing a new geopolitical world economic center of gravity develop today. This will require an accommodation of different interests. Engagement is not appeasement. Engagement will be required for our own future and for our own prosperity and for our role in the world. Realignments of relationships are taking place today. Nations and societies and governments are maturing. We should embrace this. We should be part of this. We should lead this. This represents tremendous advantages for America. Stability in the world, security in the world, new marketing opportunities for Nebraska products, for American presence. The world is also witnessing the greatest diffusion of power the world has ever seen. Much has been written, much is being written, much will be written about the power shifting in the world from west to east. A certain amount of that is happening. Where it plays out over the next 50 years, the next 100 years, I am not equipped to know. But 10 years into this century, and after the jarring gong of September 11, 2001, and after the implosion of the Soviet Union, which set in motion a new universe of new satellites, of freedoms, of rights, of possibilities, of opportunities, we are yet to understand and know where all of that goes. But I am of a very clear opinion that the concentration on common interests is as much the answer for our future relationship as any one thing. Regional stability, regional relationships are now central, not just to economic interest, but to security interest in the world. And I need not go much beyond the Middle East or Central Asia today. Does anyone really believe that if we have any hope to bring the Israeli-Palestinian issue to some high ground, to hopefully make progress on helping settle that issue, that it does not include or will not affect Iran, all the countries of the Middle East, all the countries of Central Asia? And when you further examine the regional dynamics of this, one corner of the world where three nuclear powers border and touch each other, a very combustible corner of the world where China and India and Pakistan come together. And not too far from that corner is a raging war that America is in the middle of. That, in fact, has brought into it all nations of that area, north of Afghanistan, Central Asia, to its east, Pakistan, India, its northeast, China, its western border, Iran. This is a very sharp reminder of the kind of world that we live in, the kind of hair-trigger world that we live in, why wise, careful, judicious approaches to all of our policies and relationships are now critically essential to our future. This relationship, the American-Chinese relationship, will be as much the hinge relationship for the 21st century as there has ever been, I believe, in the history of mankind, because there are now no margins of error left in the world, not just in the explosiveness of weapons of mass destruction, but again, we need not examine much beyond what's happened in the world the last 3 years. A global financial crisis, a global financial crisis, that the world has not seen anything like this since the Great Depression. There was not a corner of the world untouched by what started in this country about 4 years ago. There is ample assignment of responsibility and blame to go around. We have an opportunity to get it right. The relationship between the U.S. and China is not distant from that overall crisis. In fact, it is central to it. Well, I am grateful for an opportunity to share some of my thoughts on this issue. I know, as you look forward to hearing the ambassador's thoughts, and then we will engage in a more detailed analysis. But as I leave the podium, I want to also thank all of you and thank this state for the privilege that you gave me to serve this state for the last 12 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank Chancellor Perlman for inviting me and for his very kind introduction just now. Well, it is a great privilege to join Senator Hagel in attending tonight's E.N. Thompson Forum on World Series. Actually, this is my first time in the state of Nebraska. Thank you. I understand that the University of Nebraska-Lincoln is very special. It is Nebraska's biggest public university, as well as an educational, academic, and cultural center. I also understand that your football team, the Horned Huskers, is also very special. You have won 5 national championships. I was told by the governor whom I met this afternoon that the Horned Huskers is doing extremely well at the Big 12. So I am confident that the football team can win back the national championship before very long. So good luck to you. Well, as tonight's theme is globalization's promise, I would like to speak first on globalization and China, and then on China-U.S. relations in the era of globalization. Since the outbreak of the international financial crisis in 2008, many people have started to question the globalization process. Will the trend of globalization be reversed? How to view the impact of globalization? And how to deal with the various issues arising from globalization? In spite of the heavy blow to the world economy by the international financial crisis, the main trend of economic globalization has not changed. This is because the 3 major drivers of globalization remain effective, namely scientific and technological advances, cross-border trade and investment, and international industrial restructuring. New technologies with environmental protection, new energy, low-carbon economy, and technology at the core will continue to drive the new round of globalization. In responding to the international financial crisis, there has been more profound industrial restructuring and the relocation of resources worldwide. The effects of economic globalization as a double-edged sword have become more obvious. On the one hand, the worldwide flow and distribution of elements of production has undoubtedly lowered the costs, increased efficiency, and further improved overall productivity. But on the other hand, it has aggravated world economic imbalance and widened the gap between different economies. There's a growing public discontent and suspicion in many countries, and the mood for trade investment protection is on the rise. The risks of excessive financial globalization have also been recognized. Global efforts are needed to address the challenges of globalization. It is necessary to make globalization more universally beneficial, coordinated, and balanced. Global governance, with responding rules, regulations, and mechanisms that can rise to global challenges, needs to be improved. The establishment of the G20 provided a unique platform for enhanced global governance. The reforms of the IMF and of the World Bank are also necessary steps to improve international cooperation. Since the policy of reform and opening up was adopted in 1978, China has actively participated in international division of labor and cooperation, attracted foreign capital, advanced technology and management expertise, upgraded industrial structure, and improved economic patterns. China's economic development over the past 30 years and more is in essence attributable to reform and opening up. But at the same time, it has also benefited from the opportunities presented by economic globalization. While we pursue our own development in China, we are also making contributions to the growth of the world economy. The Chinese economy has increasingly become an important engine for world economic growth. It is estimated that China will account for more than 30% of world economic growth this year. In the wake of the international financial crisis, China was one of the first to recover and has played an important role in promoting an earlier world economic recovery. As China's economy is more integrated with the world economy, it is also exposed to more risks and challenges associated with globalization. Due to the fluctuations of the international financial market, many Chinese businesses and individuals have seen the value of their assets drop significantly. The rise and the fall of international energy and food prices also directly affected the life of 1.3 billion Chinese people. Although China's GDP is one of the biggest in the world, its per capita GDP is only $3,700, less than 10% of the per capita GDP in the United States, and ranking behind 100 other countries. Every year, 24 million people need jobs in Chinese cities. We still face challenges as irrational economic structure, weak scientific innovation, worsening environmental and resources constraints, uneven development between urban and rural areas and between different regions, and imbalanced economic and social development. These challenges are becoming more acute in the time of globalization. In China, any issue, no matter how small, will become a big one when multiplied by 1.3 billion. And any resources, no matter how abundant, will become very modest when divided by 1.3 billion. This is China's reality. In terms of magnitude and levels of difficulties, the challenges and problems we have encountered in our development are rarely seen in the history of mankind. The road is still very long for China to achieve modernization. As a developing country, China will continue to concentrate on development. China is firmly committed to the path of peaceful development and the strategy of mutually beneficial opening up. We will continue to participate actively in international cooperation and fulfill international responsibilities and obligations. In this age of globalization, the interests of China and the United States have never been so closely connected. China and the United States are now each other's second largest trading partner. China has been the fastest growing market for U.S. export. U.S. export to China has grown by 330% over the past 10 years. It grew by 33.8% in the first three quarters of this year. The United States is the number one source of foreign direct investment in China. And investment from Chinese businesses to this country has also been on the increase. Economic and trade ties between China and the United States are mutually beneficial. They have brought huge tangible benefits to the United States. First, the rapid expansion of U.S. export to China has created many job opportunities in this country. According to U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke, for every 1% increase in the U.S. export to Asia, 100,000 new jobs are created. It is estimated that between 2001 and 2007, U.S. export to China created 2.5 million new jobs in the United States. Research by Morgan Stanley has concluded that between 4 to 8 million U.S. jobs are closely associated with China-U.S. trade. Second, China's export of good quality but affordable commodities to the United States has not just promoted China's economic growth, but also met the needs of American consumers and saved them lots of money. A total of over $600 billion have been saved in the past 10 years, according to one estimate. One study by the U.S.-China Business Council shows that trade with China has boosted economic growth and lowered inflation rate for the United States. And this means an increase of around $1,000 in real disposable income per U.S. household annually. Third, investment by Chinese companies in the United States has helped to create many local jobs. Just to cite one example, when the China Ocean Shipping Company, it's called COSCO, started direct service to the port of Boston in 2002, it not only saved the port from being closed down, but also kept 9,000 jobs. Fourth, the China business has become the highlight of growth for many American companies. For some, their China operation has been the only business generating profits. According to AmCham China 2010 white paper on the state of American businesses in China, 71% of U.S. companies operating in China made profits in 2009, and 90% are optimistic about the prospect in the next 5 years. Taking General Motors, for example, it filed for bankruptcy in 2009 in the United States, but its sales in China went up by 67%, making China its second biggest overseas market. Given the fact that our business ties are growing so fast in so many areas on such a large scale, problems and frictions are hardly avoidable. What is important is to address them properly through dialogue and consultations. For some time, there are some in the United States who believe that the trade imbalance between China and the United States is caused by the undervalued exchange rate of the Chinese currency, the RMB. As a matter of fact, the root cause of the trade imbalance is structural differences in trade and investment rather than the RMB exchange rate. It is precisely the result of international division of labor and industrial transfer in the era of globalization. China does not seek trade surplus. China has a surplus in trade of goods, but runs a deficit in trade of services. China has a surplus in trade with the United States, Europe, but runs a deficit in trade with Japan, Republic of Korea, and the ASEAN countries. The majority of China's exports to the United States are labor-intensive, low-value-added consumer goods. Many of them are no longer produced in the United States. Even if the United States does not import them from China, it will have to buy from other countries. Appreciation of the RMB will not solve the issue of trade imbalance for the United States, nor will it noticeably reduce the U.S. unemployment rate. Since 2005, the RMB has appreciated by 21% against the dollar, but the U.S. trade deficit continued to grow. This proves that the RMB exchange rate is not the cause of trade imbalance. Nevertheless, China will further advance the reform of its exchange rate regime, but external pressure can only be counterproductive. We stand for a comprehensive approach to ease the trade imbalance between China and the United States. Both sides will be losers should a trade war or a currency war break out. In my view, it is of vital importance for us to cooperate in the following three areas. First, we must continue to support each other's economic restructuring. China is trying to achieve economic growth through boosting domestic demand. The next five-year plan, which is being drafted, lays emphasis on continued effort to expand domestic demand, transform the mode of economic development, and embark on the path of balanced development. The size of China's domestic market is expected to surpass $2 trillion this year, far more than China's total export. At the same time, the U.S. is also changing its high-spending, low-savings mode of growth. We should support the restructuring efforts of each other and explore cooperation in such areas as clean energy, energy conservation, and emission reduction, environmental protection, infrastructure, and modern services industry. Second, we must increase U.S. export of high-tech products to China. China is prepared to further increase its import from the United States. However, among the high-tech products that we import in 2008, only 6.9% were from the United States. This is not commensurate with the standing of the United States as the leading nation in science and technology. U.S. export to China will be greatly enhanced if restrictions on high-tech export to China be eased and real efforts be made to promote free trade. Third, we must encourage Chinese businesses to invest more in the United States. Currently, many Chinese companies face obstacles and uncertainties when making investment in this country. A level playing field needs to be created. This will encourage more Chinese companies to invest in the United States, which will be conducive to job creation and the growth of the economy in general in this country. China-U.S. cooperation has assumed greater international significance. In response to the international financial crisis, China and the United States have stepped up macroeconomic coordination, worked together within the G20 framework, and made important contributions to economic recovery in both countries and in the world. We have also had productive consultations and cooperation on a series of regional and global issues such as counterterrorism, non-proliferation, climate change, the Korean and Iranian nuclear issues. President Hu Jintao of China and President Obama have agreed to work together to build a positive, cooperative, and comprehensive China-U.S. relationship for the 21st century. This has set the direction for our bilateral relations. The China-U.S. relationship will grow more solid and stronger as our two countries share more common strategic interests and cooperate with each other in more areas. Finally, I wish to say a few words on China's relations with Nebraska. In recent years, China and Nebraska have increased mutual exchanges and cooperation. The state of Nebraska and the Guizhou province of China have established sister relations. From 2000 to 2009, Nebraska's exports to China increased by 306%. In 2009, Nebraska's total export fell by 10%. But by contrast, its export to China rose by 6% to reach $211 million. This fully testifies to the strength and potential of Nebraska's export to China. And China has become the fourth biggest export market for Nebraska. Just as I mentioned to you a moment ago, I had a good meeting with Governor Hanneman, and we have decided to explore all possibilities to enhance our cooperation. I believe that educational and cultural exchanges can serve as an important bridge between China and Nebraska. At present, 120,000 Chinese students are studying in the United States. There are 1,500 in Nebraska, including over 500 in UNL. Currently, there are about 20,000 American students studying in China. The U.S. government has launched a 100,000-strong initiative by which it will send 100,000 American students to China in 4 years. We welcome more American students, including those from UNL, to study and do research in China. I'm pleased to learn that as I speak, President James Milliken is visiting China. This is his first trip to China, and it represents a major step to enhance exchanges and cooperation with Chinese universities. I hope that the joint PhD programs, the joint R&D projects, and the Confucius Institute that the UNL has in partnership with Chinese universities will be more and more successful, thus making fresh contributions to the growth of our educational and cultural exchanges and friendship between our two countries. I thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you.
In the tradition of the Thompson Forum, the ushers will now pass around index cards on which you are welcome to write questions for either the senator or the ambassador or for both of them. And if you'll send those back to the aisles, the ushers will collect them and move them forward to the front of the stage and onwards and up to me. What do you expect one generation from now in 2035, when a distinguished former Nebraska senator and a distinguished Chinese ambassador come to the podium here at the Leeds Center, what do you expect them to say about the U.S.-Chinese relationship 25 years from now?
Well, I hope I can live as long as Well, I think there will be more interdependence between our two great nations. As I mentioned just now, that the interconnectedness between our two countries has never been so close as it is now. This is because of many things. Economic globalization is one of the factors. And I'm sure in 25 years' time, we're going to have even more deeper interdependence between our two countries. And there will be more people-to-people exchanges, cultural and educational exchanges. Certainly, there will be more Chinese tourists to this country. Last year, if my figure is right, there were about 45 Chinese that have left the country for as tourists abroad, but only a very limited number have actually come to this country, and I am sure that in 25 years' time, the number of Chinese tourists will be doubled, tripled, certainly will be more than the numbers we have today. So there will be a deeper degree of interchanges between our two countries. Of course, the gap between the United States and China will be narrowed a little bit. But this is not the determining factor. Many people have asked me if China's economy is getting closer to the United States economy or even surpasses the U.S. economy, what are you going to do? I told them that China is a country of principles. For example, we have always believed that countries, big or small, are equals. We should respect each other. We should treat each other as equals. We should cooperate each other as equals. So I really think that even if the gap of national strength between the United States and China will be reduced, I think we will be working together as equal partners, because this is very, very important for our next generations. Thank you.
And Senator Hagel, 25 years from now, what do you expect them to say about what's happened to the U.S.-Chinese relationship?
Well, I fully expect the ambassador and I to be very sprite and lively and bound upon this stage, and maybe with a jug of champagne to celebrate all the good fortune that our countries have brought to the world. I'd put it this way. I do fully expect, believe, and I feel it in every fiber of my being, that in 25 years, the Chinese-American relationship will be, in fact, well on its way to being the hinge relationship of the 21st century, that will, in fact, be responsible for a world that is more stable, more prosperous, for more people than the world's ever known. I doubt if there will ever be a time, maybe there will be, I hope, we all do, when the world has no problems. I don't think that'll be within my lifetime. But I think as you analyze this relationship over the next 25 years, it will be one that will produce a better world, a fairer world, a safer world.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the E. M. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E. M. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today's guest speakers were Chuck Hagel, former two-term Republican senator from Nebraska, and Zhang Yixui, ambassador of the People's Republic of China to the United States. The topic of their discussion was China Rising, Good News or Bad News for United States Workers, Consumers, and Investors. This event was co-presented as the Charles and Linda Wilson Dialogue on Domestic Issues. This program was recorded on Wednesday evening, November 10, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.M. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Thanks also to Jerry Johnston of NET Radio for providing the recording of today's program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, and podcasts of selected Noon Forum programs are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.